Tonight, raging western wildfires. California's governor declares a state of emergency as record heat and high winds fan dozens of fires throughout several states. An apparent insider attack in Afghanistan leaves an American service member dead and others injured. Time is running out to rescue the Thai soccer team trapped in a cave. Oxygen levels are low and monsoon rains are on the way. The world mourns the loss of an icon, the man who co-created two of our most recognizable superheroes. And the drumbeat for diversity in Hollywood as up-and-coming stars flip the script and transform what we see every day.
This is NBC Nightly News with Jose Diaz-Balart.
Good evening. We begin with a deadly and dangerous crisis in California and many other areas throughout the western U.S. Ferocious winds feeding wildfires as record temperatures have put more than 18 million people under excessive heat warnings. Our own Steve Patterson is with the firefighters and evacuees on the front lines of one of the blazes near Santa Barbara.
Tonight, a state of emergency in California. The misery made worse by record-breaking heat and high winds. More than 2,000 people evacuated near Santa Barbara. Nearly two dozen buildings already destroyed. Eric Dirtshe says he and his six kids barely made it out alive.
It was going so fast. The wind was gusting so fast last night. There was no chance.
Jeff Rainbolt took desperate measures to keep the fire from burning his house down.
Just with the shovel and the hose, I probably put out 30 to 40 spot fires easily.
Firefighters attacking it from the air and on the ground.
When you have fire weather like that with the wind and the relative humidity and the heat, it's really just impossible. We kind of go into a defensive mode and try to protect really as many structures as we can.
In Northern California, the fires turn deadly. One killed as flames there exploded across 20,000 acres. Fires burning in San Diego County, too.
We got to get out of here, guys.
It's churning through homes, even injuring a firefighter.
We had 60 seconds, maybe. We knew immediately we needed to get in our cars and go.
California's March of Flames, part of nearly 60 large fires racing across 13 states. Making matters worse, the West is baking in a blistering heat wave.
It's super duper hot, so we had to escape it.
Records shattered yesterday in California. 102 in Santa Barbara, 108 in downtown LA, and in Burbank, a sweltering 114 degrees. Excessive heat warnings expected to stay in place for nearly 20 million Americans as bone-dry conditions and red flag winds return. Firefighters once again bracing for the very worst.
And back outside of Santa Barbara, you can see the full destructive power of this fire gutting several homes along this street. This extreme heat wave leaving thousands without power tonight. All this while we're tracking a brand new fire just outside of Burbank, forcing mandatory evacuations there now as well. Jose?
Steve Patterson in Goleta, California. Thank you. That dangerous heat is reaching over the U.S. border. In Quebec, Canada, temperatures near 100 degrees are linked to 54 deaths in the last week. Many were senior citizens, a group that particular risk for health problems on extremely hot days. And in Japan today, torrential rainfall led to deadly flooding. At least 34 people were killed. Nearly 50 are missing. Many fled the rising waters on rooftops, waving to rescue helicopters for help. The waters were 16 feet deep in the worst hit areas. Storms that hit Puerto Rico and Florida last year could have some serious long-term effects on the ecosystem. Scientists at Florida International University are keeping a close watch with new technology, and they are finding the recovery is slower than meets the eye.
In Puerto Rico, clear evidence of the power of a hurricane. But only now are scientists looking beyond those destroyed homes to the trees and the forests.
A landscape that is completely green and colorful, it was overnight turned brown. And all you could see, it was like toothpicks of what was left.
To the naked eye, almost a year later, it might appear Mother Nature has fully recovered. But a hike deep into El Yunque National Forest tells a different story.
You're going to take a scan in this location?
NASA scientists from Goddard, using the world's most advanced imaging equipment, can now see across hundreds of square miles, down to the tiniest of leaves and twigs. Incredibly, airborne NASA teams had documented these exact areas just 6 months before Hurricanes Irma and Maria made landfall. The comparisons reveal what has never been accurately calculated before.
Today, we're looking at half the trees having been damaged or downed by the storm.
From Puerto Rico to here in the Florida Everglades, it is the same story. To look at this, it appears like there's lush growth. But comparing before and after photos reveal 60% of the mangroves destroyed.
Scientists here have the same fears as in Puerto Rico. If another powerful hurricane strikes, the coastal mangroves that are a protective barrier to storm surge could never fully recover.
So think of you're sick with the flu, and so the mangrove forest here has a flu for a little bit and it needs to rest. But if you do introduce another impact, that could really sort of push it over the edge.
Images that expose nature's vulnerabilities. Kerry Sanders, NBC News, the Florida Everglades.
And shocking images coming from Haiti tonight. Fires burning in the capital city, Port-au-Prince. Americans there now told to shelter in place. Some flights from the U.S. canceled after protests turned violent and deadly. People there demonstrating against a government fuel price hike. An American service member was shot and killed in Afghanistan today. Two others were wounded. They were victims of a possible inside attack by the Taliban. Our Hans Nichols is at the Pentagon with details. Hans.
Jose, this is the third combat death of the year in Afghanistan, but it's the first in the south, the heartland of the Taliban. The other two have been in the east, where ISIS is strong. And most of the 14,000 U.S. troops that are there in Afghanistan are in a train and advise assist capacity. That puts them in direct risk of meeting potential Taliban fighters who've infiltrated Afghan forces and then can turn their weapons on either American or NATO troops. Now, to safeguard American troops, the Pentagon has devised this strategy where they have something called Guardian Angels units, and their sole mission is to protect U.S. forces from insider attacks. Now, you remember President Donald Trump considered pulling out of Afghanistan. Last summer, he decided to add an additional 3,000 troops, and the goal, Jose, remains to force the Taliban to the negotiating table. Jose?
Hans Nichols in the Pentagon, thank you. The entire world is watching as rescue workers evaluate their options, none of them good, for rescuing 12 young members of a Thai soccer team and their coach. The clock is ticking as monsoon rains are on the way, which could flood the cave completely. NBC's Janice Mackey Frayer brings us the latest from Thailand.
Too much water, not enough air, and torrential rain on the way. All conditions that could spell disaster for the children and their coach if they're not rescued soon. The options are few and risky. One involves a so-called buddy dive, each boy tethered to a skilled diver. It's an incredibly treacherous task, an experienced diver running out of air and dying this week. The three-mile journey through the cave's tunnels takes an experienced diver about 6 hours, some spots too tight for scuba gear. Another option officials are considering, inserting a giant, flexible, inflatable tube.
And it will be as big as 17 centimeters in diameter and as long as it needs to be to get the kids out or get supplies in without having to dive.
For days now, divers have been placing oxygen tanks and teaching the kids the basics, the worry that they're weak and once underwater could panic.
The best plan, if we can bring them out, and the risk is minimum, maybe we try.
For the first time, letters from the cave, handwritten by the boys to their families, messages of love. One boy writing to his parents, "I love you both. Don't worry, I can take care of myself." Their coach wrote an apology and promised to care for the kids as best as possible. At the nearby temple where he works, there are daily prayers for the coach and his team. Rescue teams are drilling into the south side of the cave complex to release more water. That's being pumped out around the clock. Millions of gallons now, but many more to go.
When and how will be determined by the weather. Rain is moving in now, which could flood the entire cave system again, making an already desperate situation here far, far worse. Jose?
Janice Mackey Frayer in Thailand, thank you. In North Korea today, conflicting perceptions of a meeting between the Secretary of State and North Korean officials. The U.S. said the talks were productive, while North Korea called the meeting deeply regrettable. Our chief foreign affairs correspondent, Andrea Mitchell, joins us to help us sort it all out. Andrea.
Good evening, Jose. The North Korean statement, a stinging rebuke to Secretary of State Pompeo, with Pyongyang denouncing what it called Pompeo's gangster-like demand for denuclearization. That's only hours after the Secretary of State said that they had made progress. North Korea seems to be reverting to the same tactics it used during nuclear negotiations under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. But neither of them, of course, granted the regime the prestige of a summit with an American president. Pompeo is realistic about the prospects for Kim Jong-un to give up his weapons, but experts say that his leverage has been undercut by the president's repeated praise of Kim and Mr. Trump's misleading claims that North Korea is no longer a nuclear threat. And tonight, North Korea has flunked a critical test, refusing to fill in details of what Kim Jong-un meant by that promise to denuclearize, Jose.
So, Andrew, amid all this confusion, where do we go from here?
Good question. Military officials from both sides are supposed to meet in a week or so, but another of Kim's promises is at stake there, to return the remains of 200 American soldiers unaccounted for since the Korean War. The president said last month that they had already been returned. That, in fact, has not taken place.
Andrew Mitchell, thank you for being with us.
You bet.
Now to the ongoing immigration crisis. The government is scrambling to create a list of very young migrant children. Some of them are babies who have been separated from their parents ahead of a court order with a deadline of tonight. White House correspondent Kelly O'Donnell has more.
Today near San Diego, outside an immigration detention center.
Children, we love you.
Protest intended to comfort more than confront.
We came here for a peaceful rally to sing songs of love to the children.
Singing in both English and Spanish to support migrant children separated from their parents under the president's zero tolerance policy. Tonight, a looming deadline. A federal judge in California ordered officials to reunite all children under age 5 no later than Tuesday. And by this evening, the government is required to provide a list of children and identifying details about them so that outside groups like the ACLU can help locate their families.
They will begin looking for the parents in this country and abroad. But it's critical the government use the private resources that are available.
Urgency complicated by bureaucracy. Health and Human Services officials want more time as they process DNA tests used to match children and parents. Officials estimated that only half of the 101 children under 5 could be reunited by Tuesday's deadline. But that dire assessment conflicts with Secretary Alex Azar, who said last month children's records were computerized.
So with just basic keystrokes within seconds could find any child in our care for any parent.
Tonight, a wider search can begin.
I think there will be a lot of detective work involved in this. We are hopeful we'll locate the parents much quicker than the government is.
The court focused on reuniting the youngest children as a top priority, but those age 6 and into their teens must also be returned to their parents by July 26th. The government said another reason that these reunifications are taking more time, some of the parents have already been deported, making it more complicated to find them. Jose?
Kelly O'Donnell, thank you very much. President Trump visits the United Kingdom next week to meet with the Queen, among others, and protests are already planned. But as NBC's Lucy Kavanaugh tells us, the president does have fans across the Atlantic.
It's a controversial welcome for a controversial president. This 20-foot-tall blimp depicting President Trump as an angry baby will soar over London as the city braces for protests against his UK visit. But America's 45th president will be greeted with open arms at the Trump Arms.
God bless America.
God bless America.
Landlord Damian Smith has renamed his West London pub, hosting a series of Trump-themed celebrations next weekend to send a message.
President Trump has a lot of support here as well, you know?
The president's disdain for global institutions resonates with some of the customers, many of whom voted to leave the European Union and want to see an England first agenda here at home.
What kind of British people support Donald Trump?
It's blue-collar people who feel that they've been left behind by globalization, they've been left behind by elites, and that they're not listened to.
But President Trump's British fans remain a minority. According to one survey, just 11% think Mr. Trump has been a good president, while 67% say his performance has been poor or terrible.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists.
But his stance on immigration and trade applauded by populist allies like Brexit leader Nigel Farage.
By going out and voting for Brexit, they could take back control of their country, take back control of their borders, and get back their pride and self-respect.
A message that's likely to be drowned out by protests.
No Trump! No Brexit!
When the president arrives. Lucy Kafanov, NBC News, London.
Still ahead tonight, the Miami Film Festival hoping to diversify Hollywood by giving a voice to some rising stars. The shift underway in Tinseltown as more women and minority actors, writers, and directors are supporting each other and finding new ways to tell their stories. NBC's Morgan Radford takes us to a Florida film festival aiming to transform Hollywood.
There's a lot to begin with.
In a room filled with big ideas.
It's loosely based on my experience.
These aspiring television writers are learning even bigger lessons from Hollywood's new It Girl, star of HBO's Insecure, Issa Rae.
Clean. You're looking real bad. You're looking like a queen.
Hearing you say, oh, it's been done before, but it hasn't been done through your lens. There's a specificity that you bring to it.
She's talking to the finalists of a script writing contest at Miami's American Black Film Festival, a BET development deal up for grabs.
Do you think this industry needs opportunities like this?
Absolutely, 100%.
Why?
There's so many voices get lost in the void.
We, out of over 2,000 people, were picked. What I've been putting all my time, my blood, sweat, and tears into actually can happen.
Ryan Coogler, director of this year's blockbuster hit Black Panther, won a contest at this same festival 7 years ago.
Kind of like that first vote of confidence, and it really meant a lot.
Hollywood has long been under fire for a lack of diversity. Oscar So White going viral in 2015, and attempts to diversify TV writers' rooms over the past two decades have largely failed.
No!
Yes!
No!
Two-thirds of shows that aired in the 2016-17 season had no Black writers at all, which is why festival founder Jeff Friday says contests like these are vital.
The mantra for our company is because Hollywood.
So you're creating opportunities by people of color for people of color.
Absolutely. Who will go off into the mainstream and change the face of Hollywood.
Insecure producer Denise Davis says what's put on screen directly affects what goes on behind the scenes.
I've been on a lot of sets where, quite honestly, I was the only person of color and the only female. And I realized that as you create more authentic stories, you can actually make the crews and the industry a little bit more diverse.
And for these budding writers, there's hope that there will be a space in the industry for them to do just that. Morgan Radford, NBC News, Miami.
When we return, remembering the beloved comic book legend who managed to weave quite a web. Spider-Man fans and comic book enthusiasts around the world are mourning the loss of a legend, artist and writer Steve Ditko, dead at 90. NBC's Blake McCoy has more.
Steve Ditko brought Spider-Man to life, first on the page, then on the screen.
Oh, that was awesome.
His style? Vivid detail with a splash of paranoia. He took readers on a riveting journey, drawing and plotting the first 38 issues of The Amazing Spider-Man alongside writer Stan Lee. Then, just as its popularity began to soar, Ditko walked away. He never gave an in-depth interview. Lee rarely spoke of him, but did say this in 2015.
I was lucky enough to work with the best artists in the business. I mean, Jack Kirby, a Steve Ditko, a John Romita. There's nobody better.
Ditko went on to draw other comics like Doctor Strange, a character that KISS frontman Gene Simmons said today inspired his famous hand gesture. But it's Ditko's Spider-Man that spun a billion-dollar brand and forever left his mark on pop culture. Blake McCoy, NBC News, New York.
When we come back, a group of enterprising teens who are not only eating their vegetables, they're making sure the entire community is as well.
Yes, please.
Finally tonight, it's hard enough to get our kids to eat their veggies, and even tougher in a city where fruits and vegetables can be scarce. But NBC's Tammy Leitner found some teams who are changing that, one dessert at a time.
These young gardeners grow their own vegetables.
So these two beds actually are for beets and carrots.
But until a few years ago, many had never eaten one.
Before you started baking, did you know what a zucchini tasted like?
No, I didn't even know what a zucchini was.
Now, 17-year-old Linsa Ahmed is the CEO of Green Garden Bakery, which is run completely by teenagers.
Thank you very much.
How did you come up with the idea of baking desserts with vegetables?
The kids really didn't like vegetables, so that was a start of it to try to get them to eat vegetables.
A challenge considering this low-income part of Minneapolis is a food desert with limited access to fresh veggies, fruits, or grocery stores. Despite the odds, this three-year-old business is thriving.
It's a lemon zucchini, vegan and gluten-free birthday cake. This is the third year that this person ordered it, actually.
With veggies hidden in each dessert.
These look like chocolate chip cookies, but I'm guessing there's a secret ingredient.
Secret ingredient is jalapenos.
I can taste the jalapenos. Mmm.
Green Garden Bakery plans to make $40,000 this year. The company puts one-third of its profits back into the community and mentors more than 150 neighborhood kids.
Where's the edible flowers?
Alana Dahlberg taught many of these entrepreneurs when they were small children in a community cooking class.
What made you think that a bunch of middle schoolers could run a business?
Why not? So they had the idea and they came to me wanting to start it, and so why would I deny them the possibility to try?
But this is more than just a business.
The day my dad died, I came to work, so it was like to keep my mind straight. I think it was like a distraction to keep me going. It's like a motivation.
What would you do without this place, without these, people?
I don't know.
These teens, once strangers, now family. Tammy Leitner, NBC News, Minneapolis.
And that's NBC Nightly News for this Saturday. I'm Jose Diaz-Balart reporting from New York. Thank you for the privilege of your time. And good night.